The Gateway brings you the day's news each weekday from around the St. Louis region and the state capitals in Jefferson City.
Our schools are accredited. We don't need this bill.
And Springfield.
How many more years must pass before lawmakers see time is of the essence?
I'm Abby Larico. Join me each weekday for The Gateway on the STLPR app or wherever you get podcasts.
From St. Louis Public Radio. This is Politically Speaking.
In the race for Missouri treasurer, the fact that the current Republican treasurer is running isn't deterring other members of his own party from declaring their candidacies. One of those candidates is State Senator Andrew Koenig. On this episode of Politically Speaking, Koenig speaks on what he would want to accomplish as treasurer, as well as his thoughts on the 2024 legislative session and the election cycle. Let's hit the music.
This is the Politically Speaking podcast, the definitive show about Missouri politics.
My promise to St. Louis was that I would do the absolute most for each and every person, starting with those who have the very least.
What I wanted to do was look and see what other states are doing.
We have to be willing to change those laws, that they are balanced and they affect everybody equally.
As somebody that grew up in the St. Louis area, in North St. Louis County, I didn't know any lawyers growing up.
We got to find long-term solutions to make government better, but also to be able to provide services to people.
I don't want to leave that federal money that we've been leaving all these years on the table.
We need to be spending this money to take care of Missourians.
I thought we accomplished a lot this year, but a lot more needs to be done.
And welcome to Politically Speaking. I'm your host, State House and Politics Reporter Sarah Kellogg. Joining me in studio in St. Louis, he is the political correspondent for St. Louis Public Radio,
Jason Rosenbaum.
And also in studio, it is a studio party today. Our guest today, he is the senator for the 15th District in the Missouri Senate,
Andrew Koenig. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thanks for being back on the show. Before we get into all of our questions, we have a lot of them. I just want you to remind our listeners, you know, basically what your district is and who you cover.
Sure. I represent the 15th District, which is West St. Louis County. It used to be South St. Louis County, but with redistricting, it moved west. And this is my seventh year, and I served 8 years in the House.
All righty. We're going to get right into it, which is the treasurer race. Basically, why did you decide to run for treasurer?
Sure. I wanted to run for state treasurer to further conservative principles. I've been very effective in the Senate at passing conservative legislation. I passed the school choice, the Missouri's first school choice bill, and it's put in the state treasurer's office. I would like to expand that program, make it better. I worked on that for years and years before we actually got it done. And so, and then the second thing is they're in charge of running all of the money for the state of Missouri. I think ESG is a big thing right now, which is environmental social governance. The far left is trying to take over corporations. They're trying to take over our schools. And I would like to fight against that. And I think the state treasurer, because of BlackRock and Vanguard, are pushing these policies. They're trying to force a transgender person to be on the boards of these and then push that left agenda throughout these corporations. And as state treasurer, I believe they have a fiduciary responsibility as board members to return investment for their shareholders, and I will fight against ESG.
Okay, kind of say more about that. Is that, are you seeing like policies about that, or how are you kind of getting your information on that one?
So like, for instance, the NASDAQ, in order to be a publicly traded company on the NASDAQ, you have to have an LGBTQ plus type person on their board. And what that does is then they're going to hire CEOs that are going to be more left-leaning. And we've seen a big pushback against that with Bud Light, with also Target this year. And so as the state treasurer in charge of investing all the money for the state of Missouri, I'm going to fight against ESG.
Your decision means you'll be challenging a sitting Republican state treasurer, Vivek Malik. How do you think you'll be different from him?
Well, I'm going to be more aggressive with working with the legislature. I will be around working with the Senate and the House to push conservative policies, whether that's with ESG, whether that's with the school choice program. I want to work with the conservative legislatures to expand the school choice program and work closely with them much more than our current state treasurer.
And how do you think that will contrast with House Budget Chairman Cody Smith, who is also running for treasurer, announced on this show, by the way?
Sure. So I think I have proven myself. The Senate is very difficult to get to build consensus. Anybody can filibuster in the Senate. And I have proven to build consensus, for instance, on whether it's tax cuts. No one has cut more taxes than I have in probably the history of the state of Missouri. I passed the first income tax cut in nearly 100 years. I cut the corporate income tax from 6.25% down to 4%. I built consensus on the Wayfair bill, which cut the income tax as well. Also, like with that, we actually have the sales tax holiday that's actually coming around the corner this weekend. For the first time, that sales tax holiday will also apply to the locals as well, not just just the state portion, because it's kind of an opt-in. Then the abortion bill. I passed a bill that eliminated abortion in this state. So these are very controversial issues, and I've been able to build consensus with moderate Republicans and be able to get bills passed a filibuster.
So this is more of a broad question. Like, how does a candidate differentiate themselves in a primary for treasurer when the duties are not as expansive as, say, running for governor or running for U.S. Senate?
Sure. I think what we need at all of our statewide elected officials, if we want to be a competitive state like Florida, Texas, or Tennessee, we need all of our statewide offices speaking the same language and moving in the same direction. And so I think it's important, even if they, I think it's very important that they're conservative, pushing conservative principles, even if they may not touch that particular policy.
So it is not a secret that you have shown throughout your political career that you can win tough primaries. And in 2020, a tough general election. But these races were primarily in Western St. Louis County. And it's a whole different ballgame to win a statewide race than just having proficiency in a particular part of a particular area. So how do you plan on parlaying your relatively regional success to a statewide race?
Sure. On my last race, there was either roughly $4 million spent for or against me. And so I think and St. Louis is the most expensive place to advertise in this state. And we're going to have a strong ground game across this entire state. And so we're going to be very competitive. I'm going to be raising money. Even if I'm not the most well-funded candidate, I do think we'll be extremely competitive with our ground game as well.
One of the challenges for both you and Representative Smith is that Treasurer Malek has a large financial war chest with well over $1 million if you include both his PAC and his campaign committee. How do you approach an opponent that may be well-funded?
He may be well-funded, but I don't think he's going to have the ground game that I have. I think when we're traveling the state and we're speaking at different Republican groups, I think I can have a compelling story that people will respond to. And also, when I spend my money, it's going to be done very efficiently. He spent over $54,000 last quarter, and we're not going to be spending that kind of money.
Well, you will next July of 2024,
right, sure.
And if you're not spending money during that time, you're probably not going to win.
So I just want to make
that clear to our listeners.
I want to move on to your record as a legislator. You said you're on your seventh year, you're going to finish your final year, which is kind of, I'm sure, a blur to think 8 years and 8 years. You know, you were a member of what was then known as the Conservative Caucus, but you seem to be really adept at accomplishing things in the office within the Senate. How do you thread that needle?
Yeah, so I think what it is I'm one of the most conservative members of the Senate. According to the American Conservative Union, I had 100% conservative rating last year. But I come in knowing that not everyone is going to agree with me. And so it's my job to convince them to build a bridge and try to get them to either come to my side or sit down and not filibuster. And so I'm just relentless when I'm working a bill. I keep going over and over until I find that compromise.
Do you think that you can continue to have a policy-making impact as treasurer, given that it's not as high profile as other statewide offices?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's for instance, on the school choice bill, it is a very difficult issue to build to even get enough votes. And it is an all-hands-on-deck approach for the people that support that policy. You need someone in the state treasurer's office. You need someone in the governor's office. You need in order to get those votes and build. And also, I understand that I've been through all those discussions over the years on that bill.
Well, let's talk about empowerment savings accounts, which you're alluding to right now. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about what they do and how you were able to get it across the finish line?
Sure, yeah. And so, you know, starting out on any school choice bill, you need 18 votes that obviously pass through something through the Senate. Usually starting out, we're sitting at 15, usually 15, 16. And so we're starting at a deficit. And so I'm actually very optimistic that we can actually do something on it this year, combined it with teacher pay. You know, there's a number of provisions. The state adequacy target hasn't been raised in a number of years. So I actually think, you know, building a consensus with the public school groups that have some needs that they want, I actually am optimistic we can pass a bill this coming year that will do some expansion. But what the bill does, sorry, I didn't exactly answer the question.
Yeah, I was just going to, I was about to ask the question again, so you caught me. So good job, Senator.
So what it does is it takes the state adequacy target and allows people to donate, and the donations are 100% tax credit. And so you cannot donate to a specific kid. You're donating to these EAOs. These EAOs then hand out scholarships to specific schools. So like the Lutheran schools have an EAO. The Catholics have an EAO that they collect donations for and then hand out these scholarships for. The scholarships are the state adequacy target, which is around 6,200 is the maximum scholarship. And that can go up when the state adequacy target goes up.
So you've mentioned several times that you want to expand ESAs beyond where they are right now. For example, one of the compromises that was put forward was, I think that they can only be used in certain sized cities. And that really just seemed to be a compromise to prevent some of the rural Republicans from voting against it. Because this is kind of more for our listeners that I'm sure know this already, but there are a lot of rural Republicans that do not like the idea of school choice or school vouchers or ESAs or whatever you want to call it. So if you try to like expand it beyond large cities and bring it everywhere, do you think you're going to run into that type of opposition that required you to make that concession in the first place?
Sure. Yeah, there's a number of different expansions that we could be talking about. One is the dollar amount to make sure that more kids have access. Another one is to help the program get fully funded. It is currently not fully funded. And this is another thing as state treasurer I'd like to do is I would like to go out and raise money for the program, make sure it's fully funded. Also, when it comes to geographical expansion, right now you have to be in a charter county or a municipality of 30,000. Well, we could include all of the counties that have municipalities of 30,000 more. For instance, like Cape Girardeau County is not included, but Cape Girardeau City is. And that could be an expansion. And currently, a lot of those counties, those senators fully support the program. So right now, I think you could have a geographical expansion. It wouldn't be a huge problem. And then also, right now, this, like I said, the state adequacy target may not be enough to send a child to a private school because they don't get any of the local portion. So there could be a bump and increase in the amount of scholarships. So there's a number of things with the program. And I think this is important. We have some schools in this state where there's not a single child that's proficient in English and math. I know if I had a child that had to go to one of those schools, I would want another option. Those kids deserve another option.
Is there any way you would manage the ESA program different from Treasurers Fitzpatrick or Malik?
Yeah, so there are some rules that the state treasurer does promulgate rules for the program. What I would like to do is I would like to work with all the private schools across the state, which looks like it's not really being done, to be able to unify them to raise the money for the program. Also, there's a provision for homeschoolers that requires, like we have a thing in there, you have to do a background check. Well, if you're homeschooling your child and your child's in your house, it doesn't really make sense that you would have to do a background check, in my opinion.
One of the other roles that a state treasurer would have is being a member of the Missouri Housing Development Commission, which doles out state low-income housing tax credits. Is there any way you would want to alter that program more than what Treasurer Fitzpatrick engineered a couple years ago?
Yeah, actually, Fitzpatrick actually did have some good reforms. I do believe in – I will be looking to make that program more efficient. I do want to make sure that money is spent. I'm generally opposed to tax credits in general, but – I would make sure that those rules are being efficient and not wasted.
And also, you have to make sure that the rules that were put in place stay in place.
Correct.
Because the only reason they're in place right now is because the MDHC agreed to them. If there's a whole new group of statewide office holders that want to, like, make it less restrictive, and we're getting a little in the weeds here, but there'll be a lot of pressure from developers to make it less restrictive. How would you be able to combat that, especially if some of your other fellow members of the MDHC want to expand it, basically? I know we're getting really into the weeds of this, but this was like the most controversial issue of Missouri politics in 2017 and 2018.
Yeah, I mean, I think it obviously depends on some of the other races and who is actually going to be sitting on that board. But I will certainly try to present the conservative case for making sure that those are done efficiently and not promote programs that are wasted.
Something you mentioned earlier was that you've handled tax cuts throughout the past decade or so. Can you talk a little bit about that more and how you think this advocacy relates to being state treasurer?
Sure, because obviously the state treasurer is in charge of investing all the money for the state of Missouri, and I believe in limited government, and I want to see more of those dollars in people's hands, everyday citizens, and not in government. And so as state treasurer, I'll certainly advocate for continue tax cuts, limited government. I've passed the first income tax cut in nearly 100 years back in 2015 and 16. Then I passed the Wayfair bill, which further cut the income tax, expanded the sales tax base. Then I cut the corporate income tax for the first time in Missouri's history from 6.25% down to 4%, making Missouri the second lowest income or corporate income tax state in the country, besides the few that don't have one. And then this last year, I was part of the bill that cut it again during the special session.
Missouri still has a large budgetary surplus, even though lawmakers have passed tax cuts over the last few years. Are there any concerns that these measures could backfire in a future when that surplus is gone?
I don't think so, because I think there are efficiencies that can be made within our budget. But currently, right now, we have more money than we know what to do with.
Kind of related to that, Governor Parson cited the legislation that would end state taxes for Social Security and pension benefits, as well as allowing counties to freeze property taxes for seniors, for vetoing a number of items in the 2024 budget. What do you think of the governor's decision on that?
Yeah, I mean, he vetoed over $500 million, I believe. I didn't go line by line through all of them. We'll do that when we get to veto. It did look like some of those might have been targeted in areas of conservative caucus members, St. Charles got a lot of things vetoed. I don't put a lot of things in the budget because I'm not a big spender, but he did veto the one thing I put in the budget as well.
Was that the $500,000 for the pond at Blasis Park,
yes,
which I did a reel at for Instagram? Wow, that was going to be my next question. I do have to ask about that. That's a very nice park. And I understand that, like, you want to get state money for that. But I could also see people being like, okay, Baldwin can find $500,000 to do that themselves, and they don't need state money for that. So can you talk a little bit about that? Because that's actually been a general thing that the governor said in his vetoes, that you could get local money and the state money seems not appropriate here.
Yeah, I mean, I'm actually not going to give a lot of beef for what the governor and his vetoes, because I am a believer in limited government and less spending. And so I'm not gonna attack the governor for that at all.
Well, it's interesting. Governor's vetoes has spurred some bipartisan criticism. You mentioned St. Charles. That includes St. Charles legislators like Senator Nick Schroer. You know, he was not happy about some of these decisions. You know, others thought, you know, there could have been local nature. What do you think about kind of just overall the decision and the fact that it has kind of spurred this much kind of criticism?
Yeah, I mean, I think overall the budget was too big. And I think some vetoes were certainly warranted because of how much money we spent. Just because we have it doesn't mean we should spend it. And so, like I said, I'm not going to attack the governor for vetoing a bloated budget.
We need to take a quick break, but we'll be right back.
If you have a smart speaker, you have access to the entire world of NPR and St. Louis Public Radio. All the latest news and all the captivating stories. Activate our voices with yours by telling your smart speaker to play St. Louis Public Radio.
And we're back on the show with our guest, Senator Andrew Koenig, who is the senator for the 15th District. We're going to get right back into it. Now we have some questions about the upcoming session, which is, again, this is your final year. Do you expect that lawmakers will try to put something on the ballot that would make the Missouri Constitution more difficult to amend?
Yeah, I fully expect, I hope that we pass initiative petition reform. I think that's very important because we shouldn't treat our Constitution like it's a statute book. I have no problem if the people put an IP, a statutory IP on there, and the legislature is somehow restricted in changing that for some period of time. But to put something in the Constitution that makes it very difficult, it could be a good idea, but it might not. It might need some tweaks or some changes, and it doesn't go through that amendment process that we see in the legislature. And so I do think it should be a much higher threshold. And there's a number of ways that could be done, whether it's a majority of House districts or a majority of congressional districts are a couple different approaches, or just raising the threshold. I think this makes sense to do.
Yeah, when it went through the House, which was a 60%, and when it went through the Senate, it did end up being issues of congressional districts, how many in each area. That's kind of how it changed. Can you elaborate on that and kind of what that would mean?
Yeah, so there are definitely some conservative groups on both sides of this issue. There's some that just want to raise the threshold to 57, 60%. Then there are some groups that want more of like what we have at the federal level, where if you change the U.S. Constitution, you have to have the states ratify it, 3/4 of the states. I do have some concerns that if it's a House district, that threshold is still rather low. And so I do want a high enough threshold for it to be effective, but not so high that it can't be done.
Is there any concern that if you have, let's say, 57%, our majority with like 5 out of 8 congressional districts, that the second part of that, but with the congressional districts, could be unconstitutional because it could violate the concept of one person, one vote?
I disagree. Some of those cases, and I have to go back and remember, but when I was looking at those cases, I didn't think they had any basis in what we were trying to do. I completely disagree with that legal thought.
From a more like practical perspective, because if you put something like that on the ballot, it's going to have to be approved by voters. Is there any concern that that may be too complicated to explain to people, and it may just be easier to say we're going from a simple majority to 60%?
Actually, that was definitely one of my concerns. I thought it could be confusing, and so I've been back and forth on which way is the best approach. But what we went to conference on ended up being basically an either or. You have to get 5 out of 8 congressional districts or 60%.
So on the last day of session, House Speaker Dean Plocker said very explicitly that there needed to be movement on so-called IP reform in order to make sure that abortion is still illegal in Missouri. And to be blunt about it, what he was saying was that, in his view, IP reform, which is what the name proponents choose to call it, not me. I don't like the word reform, but I'm just going to do it for clarity. He basically said like what a lot of Democrats have accused a lot of Republicans of, and that is that they're only pushing IP reform aggressively because they want to raise the threshold to pass a constitutional amendment to make it more difficult to legalize abortion. So what do you think of his comments, and is that one of the reasons why Republicans are making this a priority this year or next year?
I think it's a priority because what we see is we have millions of dollars in left-leaning groups coming in and spending those dollars in Missouri to try to change Missouri's constitution because they can't do it through the legislature. And so I think as a conservative Republican, we want to protect our constitution from that threat. That threat could be different from year to year. It may be abortion one year, or maybe ranked choice voting another year. I mean, those are the two threats that we're seeing right now. When it comes to abortion, I mean, we don't know what exactly they're going to be putting on the ballot or if it will even be on the ballot. If they put on, abortion on demand all the way up to birth, I mean, I don't think the people of Missouri are going to vote for that. I mean, that's a radical position, saying that you can kill your child at 30 weeks. And I don't think Missourians support that at all. So it all depends on what the language looks like, what they're going to have, what kind of ballot candy, what the, you know, what the language looks like when it's on there. They could put that. Another problem with a lot of these IPs that are put onto the ballot is they put the voter doesn't necessarily read or see everything that is in the bill or the changes that it would be in the Constitution. They read the ballot language, which is often 100 words or less. And so they don't get a full picture of what's really going on.
As you said, you know, we don't know what that initiative will look like if there would be an initiative dealing with abortion on the ballot. Let's do kind of a hypothetical that say it's at, I know we could do hypotheticals all day long, but let's say 20 weeks, up to 20 weeks with exceptions for rape and incest and medical emergencies. How do you think that would be received by voters?
I think there's a good chance that voters would vote against it. Now, would I want to take that chance? No, because I'm pro-life. I believe that life begins at conception. I think all the scientific evidence points to that. There's three differences between a baby inside the womb and outside the womb. One is location, one is level of development, and one is level of dependency. None of those three things determine whether or not you're a human being. It's a scientific fact that life exists in the womb, and the state has an interest in protecting that.
So it's not even for sure that the group that's under litigation right now, which we'll talk about in a second, is even going to be the entity that puts a measure forward. Let's continue on this hypothetical train. If somebody puts a more quote-unquote modest proposal forward that simply says exceptions for people that become pregnant due to rape, incest, expanding the medical emergency, and saying specifically that no woman would be prosecuted for getting an abortion, how do you think voters would perceive that type of initiative?
Yeah, I mean, I think that something like that would be more likely to pass. But like I said, without knowing the exact language, how much money is behind it, and I mean, there's just a number of factors that would go into it.
Even though, like, we saw this kind of with Lieutenant Governor Kehoe recently saying he would be amenable to putting exceptions for rape and incest, there is a contingent, including yourself, that do not want those exceptions. But would you concede that publicly, if it was put up for a vote, that those exceptions would be broadly popular throughout Missouri? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I agree that some of those provisions would be popular, even though I would be against them.
Speaking of getting an abortion-related language on the ballot, you know, there is one right now that's been a lot of procedural delays in getting that plan forward. First, because there was a dispute over the fiscal note between the auditor's office and attorney general's office.
Yeah.
Yes. And now because of ballot summary language, what would you say to people who believe that Republicans are gumming up the works here to prevent this from going to voters? Because every day that they're either suing over the fiscal note or dealing with the summary is a day that they can't collect signatures.
Yeah. I mean, I support fully support gumming up the process. Because I do not want any measure going to a vote of the people, specifically when it comes to abortion, because that life has an interest in being protected by this state, because scientific evidence points that life exists in the womb.
So by saying that, are you not confident that opponents of abortion rights can't mount an effective campaign to essentially defeat one of these initiatives?
I'm not saying that. I just don't want to take the risk.
Okay. Now, I think this is kind of a broader question about IP, quote unquote, IP reform, which again,
making the Constitution harder to open.
Yes,
we'll go with that.
it's early. I'm just using that shorthand because it's
and,
early.
And actually, you know, like what doing initiative petition reform, the one that we're talking about, would only do the Constitution.
Right.
The abortion is a statute. So they could theoretically do that even if we did pass some kind of reform. I just don't want it in the Constitution.
Right. That's a good point. Like they could sort of redirect and do a statutory change or something like that.
And it wouldn't prohibit anything that they're trying to do. They could still do through statute.
That's an excellent point. But I guess this is part of a broader question. Republicans have been very good at a lot of things in Missouri politics, especially since 2016. They've won all the statewide elections. They win a lot of legislative races. They, you know, are able to get a lot of policies passed. But one thing that I've noticed that they've done exceedingly poor at is running opposition campaigns to some of these initiative petitions that you dislike, like Medicaid expansion, the first Clean Missouri, Marijuana, which I know is not necessarily like a, I know a lot of Republicans support legal marijuana, but isn't the problem that there's not like a concerted effort to run opposition campaigns to these things you don't like, and not the threshold issue that you talk about? Like,
well, yeah, I mean, it comes down to money. So a lot of these initiatives have a lot of millions of dollars behind them, and the opposition doesn't have millions of dollars. And so it's not a true picture. The voters are not being presented with a true fair question. They're getting bombarded from one side, and then the opposition just doesn't have the money to combat that.
But what is stopping the opposition from getting the money and organization? I mean, again, Republicans control the state. They have the donor bases to drum this up. Like, why can't they get the money to oppose some of these things?
Well, a lot of this money is coming in from left-leaning liberal groups outside of the state of Missouri. They're coming in. Like, the ranked choice voting thing is not an organic situation that's happening within this state. I mean, there's a concerted effort to for these liberal groups to go into Republican states. They did it to Alaska. They're doing it, they're trying to come in into Missouri. So for conservatives to fight that, you'd have to go out and raise millions and millions of dollars to fight it. There might be lots of Republicans who are very much against that, or grassroots people who are very much against it, but they don't have millions of dollars to donate to an effort like this.
So moving on a little, do you expect anything to get done in 2024, considering it will be an election year? People will be trying to get their issues front and center to help their campaigns. What do you think that, how's next year going to go?
Yeah, I mean, in trying to predict what's going to happen in the Senate or the legislature is a very difficult thing. But I'm an optimistic person, and that's why I've been so successful, because on the bills I work, I just never give up and I keep going at it. And so I'm fully expecting to pass a big education package with the ESA expansion, along with addressing the state adequacy target and teacher pay.
Yeah, last session, there was a big bill that you managed to get through, or, get up to the Senate, but then it go through. Are those more or less a lot of the ideas in there that you want to get done?
Yeah, that's the blueprint. And I believe there is a path forward on that.
Now, what about sport? What about sports betting? That issue has become commingled with basically legalizing slot machines in places like gas stations and fraternal organizations. And it seems like as long as those two issues are linked, there's not going to be any movement on legalizing sports betting. What's kind of your feeling about that?
So, I mean, when it comes to sports betting, I think people are doing it anyways. I'm definitely a little bit libertarian when it comes to that. I think if you want to spend your money on sports betting, you should have the right to do so. It's your money. Now, that being said, do I think something's going to get done? I'm not very optimistic about something getting done.
Is that more just waiting out for Senator Hoskins to not be there, or is someone else going to take up the mantle, you think?
I think it's probably, not this session, but the following session, it's likely to get done.
Or do you think that there could be an initiative petition that is funded by the sports teams, which ends up legalizing sports betting in a way that is very beneficial to the sports teams?
That is definitely a little bit of a concern to mine. That I don't necessarily want the teams to have a monopoly on it. I think we should have an open market.
So more or less, you're more wanting to see it passed, because that'll be more beneficial to the state if it's done through the legislature. Mm-hmm. That's all the time we have on the show. Thank you so much, Senator Koenig, for joining us today. Politically Speaking is a product of St. Louis Public Radio, which is a part of the University of Missouri St. Louis. You can follow all of our coverage at stlpr.org. And Senator Koenig, where can people find you on the internet where you want to be found?
Yep. You can go to electandrewkoenig.com. You can go on Twitter at Koenig4Mo. And then you can also find me on Twitter.
All right. Until next time. So long.